The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We apologize for the delay in hearing the second case, but several of us attended the ceremonies this morning for the Declaration of Independence. For those of you who don't know, one of the few original prints of the Declaration of Independence is in Madison for today and tomorrow. You're all invited to see it. It's on the first floor of the rotunda. So we ran a bit late, and our apologies. We have with us special guests today. Milwaukee Leadership Training Center. Would that group please stand? Thank you for coming today. And we have Lodi High School. Would that group please stand? Thank you all for coming. And we also have Learning and Retirement Group. Would that group stand? And thank you all for coming today. The students are here with us with the Court with Class program that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. These students have received materials about this case and have studied the case, and part of the Court with Class program is that there will be a meeting at noon with a justice of the court. Now, for those of you who have not previously received materials about the case, there is a summary of the case in the foyer. Does everyone have materials about the case? Okay, good. Then it'll be easier for you to listen to the oral argument. And you are all invited to stay after the presentation today of this case and listen to Justice Sykes, who will discuss the procedures of the case. Justice Sykes is on my far left. Let me introduce the rest of the court. Justice Patrick Crooks is seated next to her. Justice John Wilcox is seated to my left. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babbage. To his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With those introductions made, I'll turn to the second case for this morning, 02-1143-CR, State versus, is it Steins? And representing the state is Assistant Attorney General Shanette Campbell. Ms. Campbell.
May it please the court. Assistant Attorney General Shanette Campbell representing State of Wisconsin petitioner. There is one issue presented in this case, and that is whether the notice requirements of Wisconsin Statute 973.12 sub 1 and the principles of due process are satisfied when the error complained of in an otherwise valid notice to the defendant of his repeater status does not meaningfully change the defendant's ability to accurately identify which of his prior convictions the state relies upon to establish his status as a repeat offender. The state submits that this court should reverse the ruling, the decision and order of the Court of Appeals, in that it commuted the sentence of defendant Robert Steins to the minimum, to a maximum allowed by law, absent the repeater enhancer, based on two flawed conclusions. One, that the date error in question in this case was not a clerical error, but in fact constituted the state's reliance upon a non-existent offense to establish Mr. Steins' status as a repeat offender, and therefore that the notice provided to Mr. Steins was inadequate, thus violating his rights to due process.
What are the notice requirements under 973.12? It's the sentence of a repeater. Exactly what notice should the defendant be getting?
Actually, in looking at the legislative history and the case law, there is no specific prescription for what constitutes proper notice or adequate notice. So therefore, in looking, and up till now, seeing as how since 1878, when Wisconsin started to enact enhanced penalties, there's been no specific direction or guidance on that issue. No courts have prescribed a bright line rule up till now.
Well, the Wilkes case, which FinDOT relies on, points out that in that case there was a missed date. It was a year, probably a year or so missing. Here we're looking at one date, but isn't the point that you should be able to get the date correct?
Well, actually, I think the point is a little different because in Wilkes, you had the state concede that it was a non-existent offense, and I think the Court of Appeals incorrectly relied upon that because there were a myriad number of errors wherein a reasonable person, the court included, could not ascertain by looking at the totality of the information in that complaint whether or not this was a valid notice to the defendant. They had issues where they didn't know whether or not Milwaukee County was properly noted as the county, and then you have the concession that it was not an actual offense or conviction, and the state moved to amend, wherein in this case we have the quintessential typing error where all of the information is correct and the state went to great lengths to include the name, the county, the case number, and all of the information is correct, including the year, the month. It's just off by one calendar day. So when you go to, which the Court of Appeals didn't address, when you look at the Girard case where this court stated that an error that doesn't change the meaning of what the defendant, of the information that the defendant must know, which is the a maximum term that he's being exposed to in that case, but it goes to the same principle. What information is the defendant entitled to know when he is trying to mount his defense and decide what plea he's going to enter? So in that policy and that principle from Girard, you look at the totality of the document, totality of the complaint or the information, and determining whether or not the error meaningfully changes the defendant's perception of, in this case, which of the prior convictions the state will rely upon in establishing his status as a repeat offender.
Campbell, where was the error that occurred here? Was it in the complaint?
It was in the complaint.
Was the complaint ever amended?
The complaint, matter of fact, it was amended. And as the facts state in this case, that at the initial appearance, Steins and his attorney stated that they had received the complaint and had no corrections, and specifically stated that the repeater portion was understood in those words at record 25 and 26. And moreover, at further proceedings relating to the initial appearance, the criminal complaint was orally amended relating to the facts supporting the disorderly conduct charges, but the date error was not mentioned, and that's in record 28.
So as far as the complaint was concerned, it continued to show that date of March 18th?
Yes, Your Honor.
But now, am I correct that when the court got to the point of sentencing, everybody had a copy of a pre-sentence report which had the correct date in it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was the date of March 17th?
18th.
18th?
Which one is correct. March 18th is incorrect. March 17th is correct. And the PSI did contain the correct calendar day Which is March 17th. And that Scrivener's error did not meaningfully change the defendant's understanding of which prior offense was being alleged to establish his repeater status based on the totality of all of the information provided, especially in seeing as how that he's an interested party. It's his criminal record. He could look at that case number. Name is correct. Case number is correct. Month is correct. Week is correct. Everything's correct. Year is correct. It fits within a five-year window, but it's off by one calendar day. So a reasonable person in that situation would undoubtedly know that this is the offense that's being alleged.
How did the state prove this at trial?
With the approve the two disorderly conduct charges and the two resisting
officers? March 17th officer?
That wasn't proven until the sentencing phase with the PSI.
And was it a certified copy?
Yes.
And the verdict makes no reference to prior offenses, does it?
No.
The jury said, so is this a matter of proof for trial or is this a matter of proof for sentencing?
Proof for sentencing, but that is not the issue either. In this case, the case is notice, and that's why the State is asking this Court to clearly distinguish between what the State had, what information would amount to a valid notice at the pleading stage where the State just enters the charges and gives the defendant enough information to know that he will possibly face enhanced penalties as being a repeat offender, and then at sentencing it's clear in State v. Copen that it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt, and therefore a PSI or other official document like the certified JOC comes into play where you prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
So what's the problem here? I mean, it was proved beyond a reasonable doubt with a PSI, right?
Right.
At the pre-sentencing. So the problem, according to the defendant, is notice.
Yes.
In the complaint.
In the complaint, even though he does concede that he is a repeater. He does not challenge that, as is the case in Girard. They're both cases that are very analogous because you have an inconsequential error, where in Girard it was an error in his favor that you would face 3 years on a repeater enhancement, where it was 6 years alleged in the complaint where it was really 3 years, and he still wanted to withdraw the repeater enhancement invalidated based on it just being an error. So it can go to very vast extremes if you just say any error will invalidate the complaint, even if it's a favorable one, saying that you would face 6 years and then you would really only face three.
Who's going to?
One last thing. At the sentencing or was there any objection made by the defendant to the change of the date?
There were no objections made whatsoever.
Only the post-conviction objection.
Only at post-conviction.
Thank you.
And that issue actually has been at least touched upon, even though the court in Fields decided not to tackle it right out. They talked in that case. It brings up the same factual situation where the defendant did not, until after sentencing in his post-conviction motion, complain about the fact that there was no specific crime or conviction noted. It was just you are a repeater based on the statute 973.12.1, and the court found that that was not enough, but declined to address the issue of waiver based on just the contemporaneous objection rule that would apply to a defendant waiving his claim by failing to contemporaneously object at sentencing. They decided just not to broach the issue, but it was the same. They didn't rule out that it could be a waiver, but they decided not to broach the issue when a person waits until after sentencing to bring up the error.
But the State's argument basically is, since there's no specificity in 973.12, we have to concentrate what's adequate. That's what you're saying. What is really adequate to give that notice?
So, and Girard, I think that a combination of the principles in the test stated in State v. Girard and State v. Wilkes gives us the answer. And had the Court of Appeals properly applied State v. Wilkes, then you would have a different result. Because if you note that at page 5 of the Court of Appeals decision, they leave out the word relative. And maybe that's just a typographical error, too, them leaving out the word relative in paragraph 11. But then they begin to make a bright-line rule based on their misconception and misapprehension of the test. And they say, oh, no, it doesn't matter if it's just one calendar day off. It doesn't matter. You have to do it with clarity and precision instead of relative clarity and precision, which is what Wilkes mandated.
Now, but your opponent, the defense, is saying, well, but you use excuse me, you said Girard, and Girard is a case where basically they upheld the enhanced sentence, but then they laid out the rules, and they're saying that the charging document, we're talking about the complaint, will identify the repeater, which was done. Then it says the date of the conviction of that offense. So if you – this would not exactly comply with Girard, then would it? Because the date was not correct.
However, when
and
you –
And that's the point that the defense counsel is making.
Girard says correctly alleges, 973.121, correctly alleges.
But then it still allows for a totality of the information test. So I think there's room then there for looking at whether or not the sufficiency of notice given is really invalidated by disallowing the defendant to have full knowledge of the maximum penalty or, in this case, exactly which repeat offense, which conviction makes the status quo.
So your argument is that a little error is okay, but a big one, like in Wilkes, is would not be, right?
Not at all. Fortunately, you have both extremes in Wilkes, because the court actually says that, well, you know, we have this extreme case where it's a non-existent offense altogether. But they looked at the fact that also in the same case you have an error where the subsection 93962B is listed instead of 93962A, and that's at page 636 of the opinion. And they're saying that their interpretation of the statute is also premised upon a common sense reading of both the predecessor cases, Martin and Robles, and that we don't want to say that no amendment of any kind under any circumstances would be permitted, because this would result in unreasonable and absurd results, and that they want to avoid such results. So they give you both extremes, that, well, if it's a non-existent offense, then, of course, that's going to be invalidated for notice because the defendant's depending on that. But if it's an A instead of a B or a 7 instead of an 8, then if that would not neither the statute nor Martin Robles should be read so narrowly so as to bar such inconsequential repeater amendments. And in this case, we aren't dealing with amendments. You deal with the issue of what do you do, like in Fields, where they passed on approaching that. When the person goes to these different hearings and your initial appearance say, do you understand a repeater? Yes. Everything's correct? Yes. We only have an issue with the facts underlying the disorderly conduct. And they do amend that, and you have several chances to do that. And then you state affirmatively that you understand the repeater, but then you come back later after sentencing to kind of set up the record for appeal and say that, oh, wait a second, it's one character off. So they made it clear here in Wilkes that the one character off really does not change the meaning
Two characters off, 2 days off? In other words, if we're not drawing a line here, what line do we draw? We do it by case by case. The argument on the other side, well, the bright line is that you should have it correctly so that the defendant knows that on that date that this happened. And all I'm asking is that if you want to just give, I could give examples of, you say 5 days, 10 days, in other words, we're going to pick away at this, and wouldn't it be much simpler to put that burden on the state and require that for enhancement that you would expect that it would be correct because they have the information in front of them?
Ideally, that would work, but not in a practical sense, because you have each prosecutor having hundreds of cases each year come across their desk, thousands in the state, many of which implicate the repeater enhancement statute. And I think the wisdom of Girard and the wisdom of Wilkes is that they recognize that there will be clerical or human errors in the system, and we have to, in the interest of justice, weigh the gravity of the error, where if it's a non-existent crime over here, then no, we are not going to allow that type of error for you to come back and amend it and put a real conviction in there. But if it's an A versus a B, 7 versus an 8, they set it up that, no, we aren't going to get absurd with this and just have people having their sentences reduced based on technicalities, because it defeats the legislative intent and purpose of having the repeater, which is to give more severe punishment to those who habitually continue to violate the law and commit crimes over and over again, and that should not be removed based on a technicality that does not change the meaning. And that's where the concentration is. Does it change a reasonable person's perception of what is being set forth here? Does the A versus the B in Wilkes, which they decided didn't, even though, you know, from a technical standpoint, that should invalidate it because it's not subsection B. It should be A or vice versa.
Ms. Campbell?
Yes.
I really do want to interrupt you with a question.
Yes.
You're going on and on and on. I want to sort of examine a sort of a parallel type situation and how the courts handle it because I haven't researched this myself. The complaint here says that he engaged in disorderly conduct on March 28th of the year 2000. Now, let's assume that is the actual date, but the complaint got it wrong and said March 29th. How, and that it's for a misdemeanor, so there's no information. That's the charging document, the document that he goes to trial with. And during the trial, they prove up that it occurred on March 28th, not March 29th, as the complaint alleged. How does the court handle that?
Well, that was actually my next point in that this court should hold the state to the same level of specificity that applies to complaints, because in a criminal complaint, as State versus Fawcett lets us know, the criminal charge must be sufficiently stated to allow the defendant to plead and prepare a defense, and it need not be held to a standard of hyper-specificity. There just has to be enough information in there for, as far as the probable cause goes, for a magistrate to determine that a crime was committed and this person probably did, was involved in the crime. And then also when you come to amendments, the standard is very liberal as well. Further in the case law, or in the State versus Frye, says whether or not to allow an amendment to an information is discretionary. And 971.29 sub 2 says that at the trial, the court may allow amendment of the complaint, indictment, or information to conform to the proof where such amendment is not prejudicial to the defendant.
Well, Ms. Campbell, your argument is he's got enough notice, right?
He has enough information.
That's a due process argument.
Yes, he has enough information.
And, of course, he was the defendant in the prior cases, and he was convicted. Therefore, one should assume he knows, right?
Right.
It's only the state that doesn't know.
The state knows in this.
The state only knows when it looks it up. It doesn't have any knowledge.
Correct.
It looks it up. So the problem here is that he's got notice and the state doesn't have notice, and the state's got to get notice and it puts it in the complaint or information. So the fact that the defendant has notice and the state doesn't, why can't the complaint just say, quote, the defendant is a repeater because a few years ago he was convicted of damaging property, disorderly conduct, and then bail jumping. Isn't that enough notice?
Well,
he knows that he was convicted of all those, and he knows it was a few years ago. Why isn't that adequate notice?
Well, in Fields, that's exactly what they did. They said, per the statute, you are a repeater, and it turns out that he was. But the court said that's not enough notice for someone to wage a defense or prepare a defense and decide whether or not to plea.
And Girard said you got to give them this information in detail, because in Girard they didn't have information about the amount of the enhancement. And Girard said, well, if he got all this other information that's correct, he can figure it out, right? So
right.
Two cases that had a defect. And Girard talked about certainty on these other information. Why don't we have a bright line rule?
Because
it's so simple.
It just doesn't work practically. There will never be a system where there are no clerical or human errors. And in the interest of justice, we don't want to throw out sentences based on technicalities, which are not substantive, which are indeed clerical or inconsequential.
We do that all the time. That's what we're here for.
Could I ask you, is there, when you look at the complaint,
March 18th is typed in two different times. Therefore, I can't assume that this is simply a typo. Is there an explanation of how this happened?
Probably the same person typing just followed their own misinterpretation of that number, while yet they had, you could see obviously because there are no egregious errors like in Wilkes where the county and all of the things are wrong and the crime doesn't exist, but in this case, everything else is right. So if you have the extreme bright line rule, then you throw this out the same way you throw the Wilkes repeater out, and it just doesn't amount to a just result, because the error is not one that meaningfully changes the defendant's perception of which conviction is being alleged to establish his repeater status.
But a 1 year wouldn't matter either. It's just one digit. Here you got a one digit, it's in the date. Then you get one digit, it's in the year. You could have 30 years difference and it would still be one digit.
Then it would fall outside of the five-year.
Okay, 4 years, a transposition of the number so that it's 4 years difference.
4 years difference. Based on, I think that still, based on the facts that we have here, that the still the reasonable person would understand based on all of the information, and the state basically kind of set itself up to increase the odds of an error by wanting to have all of this information nearby. So by doing more, it kind of runs into something punitive by having.
I want to follow up on something you said earlier, if I may, just for clarification. I heard you say in response to a question that the pre-sentence investigation was a certified copy. Is that what you said?
Oh, no. The judgment, I was thinking judgment of conviction.
Okay.
But it
was the
it,
judgment
it,
of conviction attached to this complaint?
No, not to my knowledge. No, it was. No, never
one,
was.
One of the passionate cries you make is, look, this is a clerical error and there's just hundreds of thousands of cases and busy, busy people. It wasn't all that long ago in the context of an operating after revocation repeater case that we discussed and I wrote, you know, that suggested, look, you have problems, just attach a certified copy of the judgment of conviction, no problems.
But then you place the notice stage at the same level of being beyond a reasonable doubt as the proof stage at sentencing. And you might run into delays in charging because you have someone having to get the certified judgment of conviction in the three misdemeanor cases, if that's what it's based on, or the felony conviction. And basically, I think that the overall goal is still achieved without the certified judgment of conviction. In Fields, the enhancement was upheld because it was attached later.
If I may, I want to get one more question in. That is, as I understand it, you can see that Wilkes sets a bright line rule, but you try to distinguish Wilkes, and you've done that a couple of times with saying, well, look, even the county is different. But as I read Wilkes, the analysis had of the Court of Appeals in Wilkes had nothing to do with the county. They noted that discrepancy in a footnote. And I think it was maybe a one sentence. I don't want to exaggerate. Maybe it was more than one sentence footnote, but well, here it is. We are unable to discern from the record why counsel believed the repeater conviction occurred in Milwaukee County. The complaint does not state the jurisdiction of the repeater conviction. Okay, two sentences. Certainly not part of their analysis, so why do you use that as a touchstone to distinguish the rationale in Wilkes from this court?
Well, I use it in that it just adds to the confusing nature of the notice that was given and that this, the judgment in Wilkes supports the decision, whereas it wouldn't support the decision reached by the Court of Appeals in our case, because the mistakes all together combined are so egregious that the court is still unsure and they thought, well, we better put a footnote here because we're not even sure that you're right about the county. We'll say it briefly, but we still say it. We don't even know if you're right about the county. Then you have a totally non-existent offense that you admit is non-existent, and you want to come back and amend with a real offense. And that's not, and we don't want to allow that type of a string. But they did say the A and the B could be transposed, and that would be okay. One character, as we have here.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Counsel, for the defense.
Bring it down.
Donnelly.
Good afternoon, members of the court, Ms. Campbell. If it pleases the court, my name is Patrick Donnelly, and I represent Mr. Steins in this case. I would like to begin by touching on, I think, something the court touched on in some of the questions that were asked of Ms. Campbell during her presentation. I believe there was a premise put forth in the argument of the state which suggests that if this court were to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case, that it would somehow unleash a floodgate of litigation on repeater allegations. That simply is not the case. I think it's important to remember that Wilkes was decided in 1991, some 12 years ago. And since that time, there isn't a single case that's cited by the state or a case that I could find that raised the issue based on the premise or argument that there was a discrepancy between the date of the allegation and the date of proof that was brought up on appeal. And I think the reason for that is because of the simplicity of the rule and the fact that it is so easily understood and so easily and clearly administered. This case is an aberrant case, and the reason I say this is an aberrant case, again, is because of a couple of things this Court has touched on in its questions. Mr. Wilkes made an initial appearance in sometime in March of the year 2000. Some 4 months later, he appears in court for a status conference. The trial court notices on the criminal complaint that there are four counts. He brings to the attention of the parties that he doesn't believe there's probable cause for one of the counts that's charged in the criminal complaint. That would be the third count for disorderly conduct. Again, three of the counts alleged, I believe, March 28th is the allegation of the date of the offense. Count three alleged March 25th. There was an agreement that that charge should be amended to conform with what they believed the proof would be, or at least the offer of proof the state would make at the time of trial. And there was no objection to that raised by the defendant at the time.
Let me ask you just a question about Wilkes here. In Wilkes, as I recall, the defendant really relied upon the mistake.
Yes.
He entered a plea of no contest, I guess.
Correct.
Believing that the state could not prove its repeater. Here, the defendant was not relying upon the state's mistake, arguably. He pled not guilty. He insisted on a trial, and he got it.
Exactly.
To the charge, not to the repeaters.
We don't know that. And the reason we don't know that is because that question suggests what's needed here is some type of Bangor hearing, where that discussion was never had with Mr. Steins in this case. It may well have been, and it may well be, that a defendant might look at a charging document such as this and make the decision, I'm going to go to trial on this. They tell me that I was convicted on March 18th of the year 1998. They can't prove that based upon my reading of Wilkes.
But that's not even, that doesn't even come into the trial. It only comes in afterwards.
Well, that decision is made, the decision of whether or not to go to trial could be based upon the decision of how much of a penalty the person feels they might face in the event they're convicted. There's certainly a significant difference here between facing 12 years as a maximum penalty and a maximum penalty of 2 years as an unenhanced allegation. And somebody might make the decision to forego the decision to enter into a plea agreement in this matter because they feel they're going to roll the dice, go to trial, and only face 2 years.
What did your client know? He knew, in other words, he entered a plea and he read, or his counsel read, the complaint. And, of course, 973.12 says that you have to have the allegation or the in the complaint must be alleged in the complaint or the information. But it had a wrong date. What about the pre-sentence? Do you think that that has anything to do with this at all?
Absolutely. I think it has a great deal to do with this. When I began my comments, excuse me, after the time that criminal complaint is amended, Mr. Steins gets convicted. We go to sentencing. The offer of proof that's made at the time of sentencing is a pre-sentence investigation, which I think was absolutely the narrowest, the thinnest offer of proof of a prior conviction that you could have. My recollection is, if I am correct, that you have the original record in front of you, I believe that the pre-sentence investigation on the page that it showed Mr. Wilkes's prior record upon which the State was relying for proof was also a darkened version of what is in the briefs that are on file in this case. We're not here arguing about proof. That was raised before the trial court, but the decision was made not to appeal on that basis. However, we get to the post-conviction hearing in this case, which has come some 2 years after the allegation is filed against Mr. Steins that he's a repeater. The district attorney shows up at the post-conviction hearing and informs the court, in essence, I'm here today to show you a certified judgment of a copy of the judgment of conviction. And if I were to read the quote, my recollection is, I believe that this shows a conviction for March 17th. I would note for the court that the prior convictions relied on in here were Walworth County convictions. The allegation that he committed this crime was that it occurred in Walworth County. I would assume, if I were to speculate, that at some point in time between the time the motion was filed for post-conviction relief and the post-conviction hearing, the district attorney stopped at the clerk's office in Walworth County and grabbed a copy of the certified judgment of the copy of a judgment of conviction here. It didn't require a lot of legwork. Basically, my argument is here that if you accept the State's proposition that there should be some type of case-by-case analysis applied to this, some case-by-case standard, then the floodgates open, the floodgates of litigation.
Well, counsel, wouldn't, and I'm familiar with Wilkes, but I'm just the argument that your opposing counsel is making is that your client reviewed the complaint and had no corrections. Your client stated that the repeater status was, quote, understood. And when there was sentencing and your client had the pre-sentence and his attorney, that had, and you're talking about the darkened copy, but that had the convictions, the prior convictions. The difference was it had the correct date in it. And what I'm asking is that with that knowledge and with the information, the fact that we're looking at, quote, adequate notice or notice, which compares or is comparable to the due process, did the person receive due process, are we really doing this case by case with the facts? These facts are much different than in the Wilkes case, because there were a series of mistakes, time, date, court, et cetera, et cetera. Here there was one, but it was corrected and or understood and was made known to your client.
Your Honor, at that point in time, Mr. Justice, at that point in time, Mr. Steins is making an initial appearance. And the question he's asked, do you understand the charges against you? And implicit in that is, do you understand you're being charged as a repeat offender? And the answer is, yes, I understand that. But I enter a not guilty plea. And I'm going to put the State to their burden of proof in this case and put them to the test. In Wilkes, Mr. Wilkes entered a guilty plea. Mr. Steins did not. I think your characterization of the facts in Wilkes, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think is completely on point. I think what happened in Wilkes, and the Wilkes court made the point in its decision, albeit in an offhanded comment, that we take into account that this may very well be the same conviction that the State intended to rely on that they ultimately offered as proof in that case. And if I, again, were to speculate, what I would assume happened in that case is it was a Milwaukee County case, and the State confused the date of arrest with the date of conviction. I don't know that, as a matter of fact, but that's the kind of thing that can happen here. The State proposes five or six different standards here, and each suggests that, in the end, ultimately, they would require some type of fact-finding hearing. I would suggest to you that that is a waste of court resources.
Well, we're talking about cases, and you said 91. There hadn't been a case since 91, the Wilkes case. And you look at Girard, and there they're talking about, well, the totality of the information provided in the information will allow the defendant to determine the length of the enhanced penalty to which he's exposed. So in the information, the totality of what we're looking at here, in the information, there was the charge of repeater. That was in the information, which your client and his counsel looked at. Now, it's what I'm getting at is that, and I understand the bright-line rule. I'm just saying, would it be a bright-line rule if we'd say, based on this, here's what you have to have, and that this would meet that bright-line rule?
Are you asking me for a suggested bright-line rule?
Well, the bright-line rule you're asking for is that no errors, the date has to be the date.
Yeah, the meat on the bone in Wilkes was you have to prove the date you allege. That's the sum and substance of it. And that's very simple to understand. In addition, I would suggest that the notion of trying to apply a general notice requirement or notice standard as it relates to a criminal complaint to the repeater allegation is really inappropriate, and I think the legislature took that into account. There are a couple of things there.
Well, there isn't any specificity in 973.12.
Well, what is specific is that they have to allege in the charging document the prior conviction. And there have been
Which they did. But you're saying
which
it
they
wasn't
did.
Because it was the conviction, but it had the wrong date.
Well, there were a host of cases that have interpreted that statute since it was enacted, and each and every one said, at a minimum, the date of conviction will be included in the charging document. And in addition, I think the standard is that they should also identify whether or not it's a felony or a misdemeanor, the prior conviction. And the reason for that is because the statute is a time-sensitive statute. And secondly, whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor has a great deal to do with what ultimate penalty the person faces, because prior misdemeanors enhance the underlying offense to a lesser degree than a prior felony does in certain circumstances. So the bright line rule is very simple. And it may be the suggestion is that Mr. Steins had notice at the time he made his initial appearance of what his prior conviction was, but the fact of the matter is that conversation, as I said, was not had. He may well have had noticed that, yeah, I have a prior conviction, but it was March 17th, and based upon the law, which has been generally accepted and understood apparently by the courts and by the vast number of district attorneys across the state who haven't committed this particular error because it hasn't been here before, I'm sorry, I lost my point there. But
let me just raise what I have as a problem, and then maybe you'll think of your point. This is, as Ms. Campbell says, a typographical, and it's close enough. It's not a decade. It's not a large number of, it's a 7 versus an 8 or 8 versus 7. There are hundreds and thousands. I mean, this is really, he's drunk and he's acting out. Isn't that what this case is?
Exactly.
Okay, he's drunk and he's acting out. And we don't like that kind of behavior, and it's a violation of civil and criminal law, right? Trespass, and et cetera. So he's acting out. He knows darn well that when he's sober, that he committed this offense, and he might not remember if it was the 12th of March that he got convicted or the 20th of March, right? Because these things happen over several days or weeks, right? So he's not going to remember what this 17th. And it is technical, and to make the state do it again for a technical error, I mean, that's exactly what people say, you know, you let them off on a technical error, right?
That's correct.
But my problem is, sometimes the court gets all excited about a technical error and reverses. And other times the court says, only a technical error, and doesn't reverse. And I know, and maybe if you do most of your work in criminal law, you're not familiar with, you're an assistant state public defender, you're not probably not familiar with the civil cases. And in our civil cases, we had a situation where we had a Wisconsin lawyer who practiced in Minnesota and was practicing with somebody else and goofed on signing various papers, although his name was on it. Court got all excited and threw the case out of court. Civil case. Just threw it out of court, couldn't replead it. So my problem is, I don't know anymore what is a technical error that we ought to ignore, and what is a significant error that we should not ignore. Well, so what's your solution
to a basic
problem of cases in this court?
I would suggest in this context, given the fact that the decision to allege a repeater allegation is one that's an elective on the part of the district attorney. And if they elect to do so, particularly in the context of a case like this, where they are going to expose somebody to a significant increase in the penalty they face for some of the least serious crimes known to the law in the state, that they should be required to cross the T's and dot the I's. And absent that, people will meet whatever standard you set. If you set the standard low, that's the standard they'll meet. If you set the standard here, which I suggest the standard should be, you prove the crime, the date you allege, they will meet it because the district attorneys across the state have met that.
Aren't you here really because he got 12 years? Now, he was subject to 2 max, right?
Correct.
If he didn't have a repeater. His other offenses were damage to property. Did he get jail time for that or prison time for that?
On the prior offenses?
Yeah.
I honestly don't recall, Your Honor.
All right. Disorderly conduct and bail jumping. And now he's in for 12 years. Was this under truth in sentencing or prior to truth in sentencing?
This was prior to truth in sentencing.
Prior to truth in sentencing. What's the maximum he stays in prison?
Under the old law, approximately two-thirds of a sentence.
Two-thirds. So he is going to be in prison for 8 years. Potentially.
Potentially, yes.
He could be released earlier.
He could be.
But potentially 8 years.
Correct.
Where is he institutionalized?
I think he is currently at Dodge.
What does it cost to be at Dodge per year?
Thousands. 30,000.
Pardon me?
Thousands. 30,000 a year, 27,000.
30,000 a year.
That's a guess.
Is that why you're here?
No.
Why are you here?
I would be here whether he had received an enhanced penalty or not to this extent. I would be here arguing Wilkes because it's the law whether he got 12 or not. I think the facts are important because this isn't an optional charge. And in some counties in the state, the district attorney or prosecutor could have charged this as a single course of conduct with 2 counts and exposed him to 6 years, or a single course of conduct involving 1 count or 2 counts. The decision here was to break this down into 4 separate counts and to seek 12 years rather than a maximum possible potential of 90 days, perhaps, which he might face in another county. But the approach taken here, it appears to me that the state really wasn't confident of their prior conviction until after sentencing. I'm not willing to concede that this is a clerical error. It's likely a clerical error, but for all I know, the district attorney who was drafting this charging document asked the assistant next to him, didn't you charge Mr. Steins last year with 3 counts? When did that occur? And he said, it was the day after my birthday. I think it was March 18th. I don't know if I would characterize that as a clerical error or not, but that begs the question of whether or not, if we accept any of these standards proposed by the state, is the secretary going to have to come in and testify? Is the defendant going to get
Mr. Donnelly, if I may, looking at the complaint that's reproduced in your brief, the repeater clause, it indicates that the defendant is a repeater convicted of damage to property and disorderly conduct on 3-18-98 in Walworth County case 98 CM 118. Is 98CM118 the correct case?
I can't tell you offhand.
Beg your pardon?
I can't tell you offhand. I've actually never looked at the certified judgment of conviction to determine whether or not it's the same.
Isn't it, in effect, that this particular complaint, giving the defendant notice not only of a date of conviction, which is inaccurate by one day, but also the actual case number? And so if there was any question about that, it would seem to me, suppose the date of the conviction was correct, but the case number was off by one digit. What would be your argument then?
If in this case they had provided the wrong case number but the correct date, I think that would be a sufficient allegation under Wilkes and under the statute.
Why isn't reverse?
Because
you're not arguing here that the case number that is provided twice in this complaint is not correct, are you?
I'm not arguing that, no.
Well, I mean, what more do you need? The proof at the sentencing hearing with the pre-sentence investigation is accurate, and that proof has been made beyond a reasonable doubt. So it seems to me the issue in this case is whether the defendant received sufficient notice. He received notice of a date of conviction that is off by one day, but he also received notice through the actual case number, which you don't dispute the accuracy of.
If you analyze that, this case that way, that would be a sea change, I believe, in the generally accepted principle of law, in that they were required to prove, allege and prove the same date. In this case, of course, there was not a case number in the pre-sentence report that was on file. And had there been, that, of course, adds another opportunity and another layer where a clerical error can occur. You could expand this as far as you want. I'm not in a position to say that we're any – I would assume those – the case number is correct in the criminal complaint. But if due process is at work here and what the notice requirement was at the time Mr. Steins entered his plea in this case, then it failed to provide the adequate notice under Wilkes. If the court is going to change that standard, I would suggest that you do so only prospectively and certainly not apply it to Mr. Steins, because he went to trial. He put the state to their proof. Wilkes didn't. He pled guilty. Mr. Toms didn't in the Toms case, and he was given an accurate prior conviction under one theory of an enhanced penalty, and the state filed an amended document that charged him as a persistent repeater rather than a repeater under 93962. And in that instance, Mr. Toms had more notice than Mr. Steins did of what was required. They at least had told him that he did have a prior felony conviction on a specific date that apparently was correct. But the court reasoned that the state had abandoned that in the amended document, that allegation. They called him a persistent repeater but did not include a prior conviction date.
Is there any evidence in the record that your client made his decision to take the case to trial based on his ability to make a Wilkes-type argument after the fact?
There's certainly nothing in the record. There was, I assume that would have required a post-conviction, post-sentencing evidentiary hearing where Mr. Steins would have taken the opportunity to explain what his thinking was.
When did the, the sentencing occurred on September 22nd of 2001. When did the defendant get the copy of the pre-sentence report that had the correct date?
That was presented at the time of sentencing.
The day?
Pardon me?
On the day of sentencing, a week before sentencing?
I assume it would have been provided some point in time before sentencing.
The point that I'm making, and I'd like you to comment on it, is it seems to me that the notice requirement, to the extent that more and more accuracy is that the notice requirement, the real tough notice requirements, would apply more to the sentencing, because that's when it comes into play, the repeater offense. It doesn't come into play at trial.
Well, I guess that approach would be, I will take care of this at a later date. If the law were that all I had to say is you were a repeater, we allege that you were a repeater, and we'll figure out how later, that really doesn't provide him not much notice at the time.
But prior to trial, the defendant could bring a motion to make more definite and certain, could, you know, to ask the state to come up with more proof of repeater. I mean, this isn't a game. And that's what I think the public sometimes objects to, that these technicalities are just really technicalities. If the defendant's plea is going to depend upon whether or not the state can prove past repeaters, then why not say to the defendant, okay, until this becomes truly important in terms of sentencing, and you think there's an error in charging a repeater, just put the state to at least some degree of proof, of accurate proof, when you think so. Otherwise, you're not entitled to total, strict accuracy as to the September 27th or September 28th until it starts to come into play, which is the sentencing.
If that were applied to Mr. Wilkes, of course, if that standard had been applied, he would have been required sometime prior to sentencing to tell the state and the court that, hey, the state has this wrong. Under their theory of prosecution, I'm really not a repeater, but I'm here to tell you that I am because I know of another conviction.
I understand that Wilkes is a problem with my proposition, but I'm, of course, suggesting that maybe there's something wrong with Wilkes, and maybe it's not a proper, a common-sense approach to what is really a technical problem, at least appears to be technicality in this case.
I would only suggest that in this particular context, that it's not a technicality given the constraints of the repeater statute itself, which is, as I said, time-sensitive. I could see, under the state's theory, not including a date of conviction at all as being sufficient. But then we don't know anything about the five-year limit or how much time a person's been in custody to subtract from that five-year time limitation.
But you can find all that out, can't you?
Well, the burden of proof is on the state.
Does this involve a privilege against self-incrimination?
I certainly potentially could, particularly in a context where a defendant enters a not guilty plea.
The burden of proof is on the state to prove beyond reasonable doubt that the defendant committed the crime. The burden of proof is not upon the state until sentencing on this repeater thing.
But for the fact that I believe the legislature put a burden of proof in this particular context to provide notice at the time of plea.
Since Wilkes, we have the Girard case, and my understanding of the Girard case is that it allows amendment of post-plea, it may be amended post-plea to correct clerical error in sentence portion of penalty enhancement if the defendant is not prejudiced. So first of all, you need a clerical error. I'm not sure what a clerical error is. Does that mean it's an error by a clerk or someone doing clerk-like work? You know, what if the error was done by the assistant district attorney? I don't know what a clerical error is. But setting that aside, even if I would say that this is a clerical error, I then have to look at whether or not the defendant is prejudiced. Do I know if the defendant is prejudiced on this record?
Well, of course, under precedent, under prior law, this Court has said that in the context of the failure to provide notice, prejudice is not a consideration.
But what do you do with Girard?
In the context of why that's different than this case?
Yes.
Because in Girard, the error that was committed did not get to that area of notice that the statute envisions, that being, what is the predicate crime? That is really what puts the person in harm's way, as it would be, to face a repeat offender charge.
In Girard, it was the number of years that was the potential exposure.
Correct.
Which he could figure out if he knew which conviction was in issue.
Giving Mr. Steins the benefit of the doubt, that may be.
Well, I'm talking about Girard. In Girard, you didn't have to give the years of enhancement. No statute required that. But if he had every single thing right, according to Girard, about the conviction, he could figure out the enhancement because that's a question of law.
Correct.
Is that what Girard said?
I believe so.
Mr. Campbell, if I may come back for just a moment. We have all kinds of requirements in the criminal law that seemingly puts some burden on the defendant. It's up to the defendant to raise a motion to suppress. If the defendant believes something went wrong in a search and his rights were violated, it's not up to the state to raise that. It's up to the defendant to raise that. So what's wrong with saying, okay, if you think this is important prior to the start of trial, defendant, raise a motion to get rid of this or whatever and put the state to its proof at an earlier time than it normally would have to. Because in answer to one of my questions, you said it was a problem of burden of proof. Well, I don't consider that. I would need you to justify that a little bit more, well, given what we demand of defendants in other criminal cases.
In this context, the state is elected to expose him to a much greater penalty and to require him to come forward when the state has committed an error that's going
to raise the question. Just like we say to the defendant, you've got to raise the question that a search was illegal. It's up to you, defendant, not up to the state.
I guess in the context of whether or not as a matter of law someone would even be a repeater if it was outside the 5-year limit, the state made a mistake and the defendant doesn't raise that objection, that turns the law on its head. It would be potential that he could waive the fact that he's even a repeater at all if the error that's committed places him inside the 5-year notice. But and no one mentions it, no one objects, and it's discovered later that, in fact, that offense occurred outside the 5-year limit, and it's waived. As a matter of law, he would be serving a sentence that couldn't even be imposed. So I really think the burden should lie with the state here, that if they are going to elect to expose someone to this type of penalty for this type of offense, they bear the burden of being clear and concise and consistent, which I believe they've been, that it's been the laws that exist now has been applied in a very consistent manner, and this has not been an ongoing problem because the law has been so definite. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Donnelly. Ms. Campbell?
Drawing attention first to counsel's assertion that this really wasn't a very serious crime and the state just elected to place these repeated, you know, by the way it charged, it could have charged one continuous act instead of four, when actually when the facts are reviewed, this is very egregious for the record to have someone who admittedly is HIV positive threatened to kill by spitting and biting emergency care workers who are trying to assist him and having to have a spit shield and hood placed upon him and continuously physically fights and batters the people who are trying to help him, promising to kill them because he is HIV positive and having that knowledge
wouldn't
be.
Is that all this from what, the PSI?
No, from reading the record, and I didn't brief it because the focus was upon the repeater enhancement, but since counsel broached that issue that, you know, you don't want this guy in for 12 years for something that's not really that bad.
I raised that issue, and he's got a long record dating back to 80. That's on page 108, dating back to 83, in which he's got a lot of probations, and then the probations are revoked for acts, and the acts are generally resisting and obstructing arrest, battery, disorderly conduct.
Yes, so just in making that point. And then with counsel's argument on the evolution of the law, which was somewhat pointed out, since Wilkes, you've had Girard that gives the totality of the document test, and it specifically deals with notice. That's why it's most analogous to ours, whereas most cases deal with challenges to the proof, whether the PSI is a sufficient document. And by the way, the statute does say that it's not a thin source of proof. It's prima facie proof of the person's prior conviction. So it is an official court document just as an FBI report would be or a certified judgment of conviction would be. So it's not a thin source of proof per 973.12.1.
But you use the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the standard you're asking.
When it's the proof stage, and that is correct at sentencing, that if you're basing the 12-year enhancement on the fact that he has all of these priors, you then need to have the certified copy or the PSI, which are equally competent to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he is a repeater. But at the notice stage, what you're trying to do, which is what Fawcett said, is allow a defendant to plan his defense and decide whether or not he wants to, what kind of plea he wants to enter. And this, in this case, the information given did give him enough information to be able to plan a defense. And that's the purpose of notice. Whereas specifically the Trammell case says that minimum due process just requires notice of a claim. And in this case, you have that. You have notice of his exposure to the repeater enhancement. And with the totality of the information, as Gerard says, you have that. And then with the evolution of the law further in Campbell in 1996, you have the court saying that based on Gerard, they are going to look at the totality of the circumstances, so to speak.
So if you're going to rely on Gerard, it seems to me you have to remand then, because you have to first look at the error, and then you have to determine if it's prejudicial. And are you asking us as a matter of law to declare that it's not prejudicial here, or do we have to remand for a hearing to determine if it's prejudicial?
It certainly could be remanded to for further proceedings consistent with your determination that a totality of the circumstances test or totality of the information provided in the complaint test is the valid test, and the Court of Appeals did not apply that.
Well, but, I mean, isn't part of that test, then, prejudice?
Yes, it is.
Can you determine prejudice on this record?
You can actually determine prejudice because what Gerard says is that, well, you know, is it kind of a smokescreen issue? Do you have information that blurs the vision, the capacity of the defendant to understand the information that he needs to prepare his defense or to understand the maximum penalties in that case? Is that perception blurred? And in this case, the state would submit that it's not because of the inconsequential nature. As Wilkes recognized with the sub A versus B, you really don't have something of any consequence. Therefore, you would not commute the repeater based on these inconsequential errors. So the case law, as it stands already, supports the state's argument because Wilkes made the exact same comparison by the inconsequential error it had in that case versus the egregious error that it had in that case. And
thank you, Ms. Campbell.
Thank you.
Your time is up. Thank you, Ms. Campbell, and thank you, Mr. Donnelly, for engaging in this spirited discussion of a one-digit case. 02-1143-CR State v. Steins is now closed. Justice Sykes will come back and discuss the procedures of this court with you all, and she'll be out in just a moment. And the court will take a one-hour lunch break until 1:45, when we'll then get timely for our third case today. We are in recess.
Sure, why not? Wait a second, am I an oil slick now? My skin is all over oil. Hold on.
No, it'll be maybe 3 months.
Oh, okay.
They make decisions like 3 months.
Oh, all right. I didn't know. Okay.
Hey, can you take a picture of me with my class? Sure.
We learned to see if you want to.
I'm going to take my seat. are. Okay, hey, Richard.